Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Being Jeremiah 46 through 51. The reason to cover so much is this is Jeremiah speaking to the nations. Now, he'd been appointed a prophet to the nations in chapter 1, and now he's going to fulfill that. He probably never went to these nations, but he did record what God was going to do with them and for them. This is a very important passage for several reasons. It shows God's sovereignty over all history. Several times through here, God's going to say, I'm going to bring you back. It shows God's love for all people. It also shows that God is in control of history, all history. And that's so important for us to see. It's not unusual for the prophets to speak to the nations. We have several accounts in the other prophets. Amos 1 and 2. Isaiah 13 through 23, Zephaniah 2, Ezekiel 25 through 32 are all examples of God's prophets speaking to different nations. Now, I'm going to go through this, and I'll show you on the map where it is, and then we'll talk about that country. We've got several to go through, so let's go through it together. We're going to start with Egypt now. Chapter 46 is broken in two parts. 1 through 12 is an introduction and a poem that deals with the Battle of Carchemish, and you see the name there in verse 2. This happened in 605 B.C. Pharaoh Necho II was moving up through Palestine to try to help the remnant of the Assyrian army that was fleeing from the Babylonians up the Tigris and Euphrates Valley. This was a Hittite city at the headwaters of the Euphrates River, where the battle between the remnants of the Assyrian army and the Egyptians fought against the Babylonians, and the Egyptians and Assyrians were terribly defeated. And Pharaoh Necho went back home. This is the same time where when Pharaoh Necho came through, he deposed the Davidic king, the son of Josiah, and put his vassal in his place. And all of this is happening at this time. Now, in verses 13 through 26, we have a supposed invasion into Egypt. Now, we don't have a whole lot of historical evidence on this. It was obviously a foiled attempt. Babylon was strong enough to keep Egypt in her own country, but Babylon could not invade Egypt. And that's what 13 through 26 is all about, this invasion of Egypt. Let's look at some of the important parts, if we could. Notice it mentions the defeat of the Babylonian army, of the Egyptian army in verse 2. You might want to see 2 Kings 24:7 for a description of that defeat. Now, Pharaoh Necho reigned from 609 to 593 B.C. And so you can see he had a very long reign. He was a very strong king. Notice it mentions, in verse 9, we see part of the problem of the Egyptian army was that they were mercenaries. Notice it says Ethiopia, Put, and the Lydians. These mercenaries looked real good, and they were even larger army than the Babylonians. But under stress, they always broke and ran, and that's going to be one of the problems of this entire army. You might want to see Ezekiel chapter 30, verse 5. There are many parts of this I can't deal with in detail. It's in your outline. I've written it very extensively. I've given you a chart of the different nations and the different gods and the reason for judgment and who's going to do the judgment and any messages of hope. And that outline, I think, that chart will be very, very helpful to you. Notice that now in verse 11, we mentioned Gilead as famous for her medical salves. We learn from Herodotus that they were right on a caravan route, and all of the balm that came from the east went through Gilead, and she became famous for that. In the same verse 11, you also see that Egypt was famous for her medical remedies. We learn that from Homer and also from Herodotus. And so here we have a sign that even though they're famous for their medical centers, they will not be healed, for God is in control of history. Now, beginning in verse 13, this supposed invasion by Nebuchadnezzar of Pharaoh Necho's Egypt. Now, these three cities mentioned in verse 14, Migdol, Memphis, and Tamphes, are barter cities in the delta. And that would be the first cities to fight. Now, in verse 15, mine says the mighty ones become prostrate. But this follows the Peshitta. But the Septuagint has Half, H-A-F, which is the bull god of fertility of Egypt. And the New English Bible has, why does Apis, which is another name for Half, flee? Why does your bull god not stand fast? And so I think it's a reference to one of the Egyptian deities. And so I would follow the New English Bible or the Septuagint here. By the way, Josephus tells us about this second poem, verses 14 through 24. There's no historical record, like I said, but Josephus says that the 5 years after the fall of Jerusalem in 581 is when Babylon invaded Egypt. There's an inscription that we've learned. It's in the British Museum. It's somewhat damaged, but it talks about a Babylonian raiding party that tried to enter Babylon in 568. Now, I believe Jeremiah is probably writing this somewhere around this period, 560s, okay? Now, notice it says, notice in verse 17 it says, they cried, Pharaoh, king of Egypt, is but a big noise. Well, that's his own people. And apparently they're saying he's just a bag of wind, a bunch of hot air. That really blessed him. Notice in verse 18, Yahweh as king. Now, he has always been king of Israel. The human king was only a representative. That was the 1 Samuel 8, 7. Now, Carmel and Tabor, mentioned in verse 18, are not high mountains, but they're very conspicuous because they rise out of a very flat geographical area, topological area. And so they're very conspicuous. In verse 20 and 21, the mercenary army is mentioned again in 46:9. Notice it says, in verse 22, like a serpent, many think this is another Egyptian god. Now, in verse 25, notice it mentions Amon of Thebes. This is another Egyptian god. This is Amon-Ra, the imperial god of Karnak and Thebes. Now, Pharaoh was also considered to be a god, the son of Ra, the sun. And then we have, along with her other gods. And so here we have God going against the idolatry of Egypt. But notice verse 26. Afterwards, however, it will be inhabited as in the days of old. God promises to restore Egypt. She's never going to be a powerful nation. She's never going to be able to subdue the world, but God will restore Egypt to her own land. Now, verses 27 and 28 are very similar to part of the book of consolation. Remember, chapter 30 through 33 was a ray of hope in the midst of all this judgment. Well, 27 and 28 are almost the same as chapter 30, verses 10 and 11. Now, in chapter 47, 1 through 7, we're going to talk about the Philistines. Now, the Philistines were a sea people from the island of Crete that settled on the they tried to invade Egypt and lost. So they settled on the southern coastland of Palestine and established 5 major cities. They were a real problem to the people of God during a part of their history. Now, Philistia is very much related to the Phoenicians who settled on the northern coast, just north of Palestine, all right? So this is a judgment on them. Notice it, verse 2, it mentions water from the north. This seems to be a reference to Babylon invading. The chariots in verse 3, that was the ultimate military weapon of their day. Notice Tyre and Sidon in verse 4. These are the Phoenician coastal cities, a related people that would not be able to help. By the way, the remnant of the coastlands of Camphor. Camphor is another name for Crete. You might want to see Amos 9:7, why we think the Philistines are for Crete. Now, in verse 5, my Bible, the New American Standard, has, O remnant of their valley, how long will you gash yourself? Well, that obviously doesn't make sense, O remnant of your valley. From a Ugaritic, we learned that this is a possible translation is strength. And maybe that's true. Oh, strength, where is your strength? The idea about gashing yourself is related to pagan mourning rites. You might well see Leviticus 19:28, 21:5, and 1 Kings 19:28. Ashkelon, mentioned in verse 7, is another one of those 5 major cities of the Philistines. Okay. Now in verse 48, we're moving to God's judgment on Moab. The difference in Moab, all of chapter 48 is about this little bitty country. It seems to be much larger than its size, and yet that it's so detailed, so many cities, we don't know where they are. So many geographical details. Now, this is very similar, chapter 48, to Isaiah 15 and 16. Now, Moab was a descendant of Lot by one of his daughters, Genesis 19:37. There was really bad blood between the Jewish people and the Moabites. You might want to see Numbers 22 through 25, where some of that bad blood is mentioned. Now, Mount Nebo is not mentioned in verse 1, but Nebo the city is, because it's going to be destroyed. And another city is mentioned, Kirithim, is named on the Moabite stone. We don't know exactly a lot about it, but it's named there, we're sure. Now, then in verse 2, you see it says, you two madmen will be silenced. This is a play on the Hebrew word in probably another city. The Jews like to change the vowels of foreign gods and foreign places and make them something ridiculous. And that's the idea of madmen here. And I think it's another city. In verse 4 it has, her little ones have sounded out the distress cry. But the Septuagint has, as far as Zoar, which is one of these cities. It seems to be fit the context better, Zoar, instead of her little ones. And then in verse 5, Luleth, you might want to see Isaiah 15:5. This seems to be a reference to a hill between Zoar and Raboth. So geographically, it's probably another site, a hill, instead of a place name like that. Notice in verse 6 it says, you may be like a juniper in the wilderness. Now, the American Standard Version has tamarisk, which is simply another name for a desert plant. But the New English Bible has sand grouse. And the Jerusalem Bible, along with the RSV and the Septuagint, has wild asses. And so, obviously, the Hebrew word here is very obscure. And in verse 7 is one of the problems that Moab was going to be judged for, because she trusted in her own fortifications. Now, you may have her own achievements, but the Septuagint has trust in your own fortifications, and that seems to be what she was bragging on, that she was inaccessible, up on a plateau and very hard to get to, and so she thought she was trusting in her geographical fortress instead of in God. Notice her chief god is mentioned in verse 7, Chemosh. You might want to see Numbers 21. 29, 1 Kings 11:33, and 2 Kings 23:13 for this Chemosh, the god of Moabite. Now in verse 9 it says, give wings to Moab. Now the Masoretic text is the word blossoms, and that doesn't sound right. The Septuagint has a highway sign. The New English Bible has salt, which comes from a Ugaritic background, so we're not real sure what wings to Moab mean either. Now in verse 10, is the concept of holy war, which we saw back in chapter 46. I didn't have time to go through it. 46 verses 10 talks about the sword drinking up the blood, and the war is for God. This is going to be mentioned in 48:10 and 50 verse 21, this concept of holy war. Now, in verse 11, Moab has been at ease, undisturbed, resting on his lees. That's from the wine industry. It means undisturbed. They thought they were geographically secure. Chemosh is mentioned again in verse 13, along with Bethel. Now, Bethel is a site where Jeroboam, which when the kingdom split to the northern and southern tribes in 922, Jeroboam, to keep his people from going to Jerusalem, set up the worship of the golden calves at Dan the north and Bethel the south. So it's a reference to idolatry. In verse 25, it says the horn of Moab. Remember, the horn in the Bible speaks of strength and power, and that's the reference here. Then in verse 29 is another reference to their arrogance. It's why they were judged. You might want to see verses 26 and 42 for that arrogance again. Let's see. Notice in verse 36, a funeral rite is going to be done for them. Notice the use of flutes twice, and that's a sign of mourning. It's used at the funerals. Notice the four mention of things that were done for mourning in verse 37. The head is bald, the beard is cut, gashes on the hand, sackcloth. The two that aren't mentioned are dust on the head and the clothing being torn. And those are the six major signs of grief. Notice again in verse 47, God's going to have patience and restore the fortunes of Moab. So here we have a promise of restoration. Now in chapter 49, verses 1 through 6, is Ammon, the sons of Ammon. These are also descendants from Lot. Lot's youngest daughter, and that's Genesis 19:38. The children of Israel are told not to hurt this people in Deuteronomy 2:19. They're to treat them kindly, though there was some bad blood here. Now it says Malcom in verse 1. That's their god. It seems to be a corruption of the Hebrew word Melech or king. It's spelled two other ways. Milcom or Molech seems to be the same god. This is the chief god of Ammon, mentioned in 1 Kings 11:33 and verse 7 too. Okay, 11, 7 and 33. Now, take possession of Gad. This seems to be related to Tiglag-Pileser III's capture of this region in 733 B.C. You might well see 2 Kings 15:29. And when he left, the Ammonites annexed this land. And that's what one of the problems with their judgment was. But notice verse 6. God's going to have compassion on them and restore them to their land. Now, in verses 7 down through, I think, the end of this chapter, let me see, down through 22, is Edom. Now, Edom means red. It is called Idumea in the New Testament. Herod is from Idumea. Now, Kimchi thinks it refers to Rome, because this name red is used for Rome later on in rabbinical literature, but here it's got to be the nation of Edom. They are descendants of Esau, and they are also known as from Mount Seir, Genesis 32:3, Numbers 24:18. Israel was also told to treat them very kindly, and that's in Deuteronomy 23:7-8. There was bad blood between the Edomites and the Israelites. Let me give you a series of passages, if I could. Numbers 20, verse 14 through 21, Judges 11, 17, 1 Kings 11, 15 and 16, 2 Kings 14, 7, 1 Chronicles 2, 5, excuse me, 1 Chronicles 25, 11 and 12, 2 Chronicles 28, 17, Ezekiel 27, 12 through 14, and the whole book of Obadiah deals with the bad blood between the people of God and the Edomites. Now, Teman in verse 1 is one of the cities named after the grandson of Esau, Genesis 36, 11. Notice it says in Dedan, this is an oasis, a descendant of Ham, Genesis 10, 7, and Genesis 25, 3. Verses 9 and 10 are almost exactly alike, Obadiah 5 and 6, as verses 14 through 16 is almost exactly like Obadiah verses 1 through 4. So obviously there's been some borrowing here. Now when it mentions here in verse 12, who were not sentenced to drink the cup, the idea of a cup is a common biblical metaphor for someone's destiny, but usually used in the sense of judgment. Now we'll see Psalm 75:8, Psalm 60, verse 3, Isaiah 51:17, Ezekiel 23, 31 through 34, and then in the New Testament, Mark 14:36. Notice it says that all their cities will be a perpetual ruins, and boy, that's true today, it just uninhabited. In verse 16, where it says the rock, this seems to be a reference to what's called the Rose City, or Petra, which later became the capital of the Nabateans. It was right on a caravan route. It was very, very wealthy city, carved into rock. But when the caravan route changed, the city just died. It was never invaded. It just died. Verse 18 mentions Sodom and Gomorrah with its neighbors. Now, its neighbors are called Adamah and Zeboiim, Genesis 18 and 19, and Deuteronomy 29, 23 through 25. Now, verses 23 through 27 deals with Damascus, which is, of course, the capital of Syria. Now, Hamath and Arpad are also two Syrian provinces, okay? Now, this area fell under Tiglath-Pileser III. Damascus fell in 732 B.C., and Hamath and Arpad fell in 738 B.C., okay? Now, notice Hadad, the god, is mentioned in verse 27. Ben-Hadad is the name for the Syrian rulers, like Pharaoh's name for the Egyptian rulers. Now, Hadad is the storm god, much like Baal of the Canaanite pantheon, okay? Now, in 28 through 33 is Kedar and the kingdoms of Hazar and the men of the east, three different groups. They're all Arab tribes, okay? They are descendants of Ishmael. You might want to see Genesis 25:13. They are very similar to the Bedouin tribes today. They are known for their black tents, okay? And there are several references to them. You might want to see your reference Bible, and they will have those in the side. Notice it mentions those who cut the corners of their beard. Verse 32, only Arabs cut their beard. Jews do not cut their beard. It seems to be related to some kind of pagan rites. You might want to see Leviticus 19:27, Jeremiah 9:26, and 25:23. Now, the New English Bible here has fringes of the desert instead of cutting their beards. Okay, there's a lot of emendations in the New English Bible. And verse 33, the haunt of jackals. If you'll see chapter 51, verse 39, where it has ostriches, these desert creatures, we've learned from archaeological discoveries, seem to relate to demon gods of the surrounding areas. And we've had a hard time translating those in the English Bible until some of these later archaeological finds. Now, in verse 34, we're going to have Elam. Now, Elam is 700 miles east of Jerusalem. It's on the far side of Babylon. It'd be somewhere near modern Iran in the plains of Kuristan, long way away. Now, why exactly they're mentioned, we're not sure. It's the son of Shem from Genesis 10:22. Now, Elam is going to be present at Pentecost in Acts 2:9, which seems to be a fulfillment of verse 39, which talks about them being restored by God. Notice it's dated here at the beginning of the reign of Zedekiah, which is 597 B.C. Okay? Notice it says, break the bow of Elam. That's verse 35. They were known for being archers, and they were part of Nebuchadnezzar's army that invaded. Now we'll see Isaiah 22:6. Then the verse 36, the four winds. This is a metaphor for judgment. You might want to see Ezekiel 37:9, Daniel 8:8, and Zechariah 6:1-8. Okay? Now notice that in verse 39 is the promise of restoration. Now finally we have chapters 50 and 51 is what God's going to do to Babylon. Now Babylon is called by the Chaldeans or Babylon. It's Neo-Babylon, a different racial group than the old Babylon. Nebuchadnezzar II is mentioned specifically in verses 50:17 and 51:34. He died in 562 B.C. So I think Jeremiah is writing around that 560 period, okay? When it says through Jeremiah in verse 1, the Septuagint totally omits that. Now when we come to verse 2, we have two of the gods of Babylon mentioned, Baal and Marduk, which is also called Merodach. Now, Baal means Lord or Master, and it seems to be used of Enlil, E-N-L-I-L, which is the storm god. Later on, Marduk became the chief god, and he is the creator god in the Babylonian creation epic, or the Gilgamesh epic. Goes by two names. Okay? Now, it says, notice the latter part of verse 2, it says, her idols. Well, the Jews changed this name. They changed the vowels again and made it dung pellets. Oh, that blessed them, didn't it? From the word to roll, Hebrew word to roll. Now, you might want to see Leviticus 26:30, where that's used, Deuteronomy 29:17, 1 Kings 15:12, 21:25, calling those idols dung pellets. Notice this nation against her from the north, verse 3. This seems to be in 539 when Persia did it, and yet we're not 100% sure what this metaphor means. The north, again, is the symbol of destruction. Persia was slightly to the north, the Medes and the Persians of Babylon. In verse 4, it mentions they will go weeping. Let's talk about the Jews now. And they will seek the Lord their God. This seems to me to presuppose repentance and faith was the two criteria for being right with God. Mark 1:15, turning from self, turning to God. Repentance is from, faith is to. And both seem to be involved. Notice it mentions there are shepherds down in verse 6. Religious and political leaders. You might want to see Ezekiel 34. These mountains mentioned in verse 6 are probably the site of Israel's fertility idolatry. Now in verse 11, it talks about a threshing heifer. And there are several different ones. Masoretic text has threshing heifer. But Septuagint and Revised Standard Version has a heifer at grass. And Peshitta has fat heifer. So there's many different ones here. Well, I'm kind of running out of time. Notice in verse 17, the king of Assyria, Sargon II, and Nebuchadnezzar II of Babylon are mentioned. They took the two different northern 10 tribes, southern 2 tribes into captivity. God's going to pardon all their sin, verse 20. What a great promise. This word pardon is only used for God and never for anybody else. Now, in verse 21, there's a play on these two place names. One means rebellion and one means punishment. One seems to be a northern province of Babylon. One, a southern province of Babylon. Notice in verse 29, the Holy One of Israel is the only place in Jeremiah it's used. It's used quite often in Isaiah. Verse 34, the word Redeemer is the word Goel, the kinsman Redeemer, buy back someone. Often used of God. See your outline for so many times in Isaiah. Desert creatures in verse 39 and 40 are demons, we believe. Now, in verse 51:1, this Leb Kamek seems to be a code name for God. There are several code names for God through here. Different ways, code names, excuse me, for Babylon. Talking about the city of Babylon. Notice in verse 11, full of quivers. Well, the American Standard Version has hold firm your shield, which seems to be from Akkadian root. And we've done that several times. The Medes and the Persians, or king of the Persians, excuse me, king of the Medes mentioned in verse 11, seems to be a reference to Cyrus, and yet it's plural, so we're not real sure exactly what that means. Verses 15 through 19 really follow verses 10, 12 through 16, so it's repeated. Verses 20 through 23 seem to refer to Babylon in her strength. 27 mentions three of these Armenian countries that are going to be a part of the judgment. These are all in modern Turkey. Wish I had more time. Verse 34 is a metaphor of gluttony applying to Nebuchadnezzar. He's eaten all these people and now he's going to throw up the Jews. Notice this idea in verse 41, Shishak, that's another code name for Babylon. That's the second one we've had. It's missing in the Septuagint. You might want to see Jeremiah 25, 26. Notice there's another god mentioned here in verse 42, the sea god. This is Tiamat, which is the chaos monster of the Babylon creation epic. Baal's mentioned in verse 44. By the way, the son of man is mentioned in 43, which simply means human being. Now we'll see 39:33, where son of man's used there again. Even the walls of Babylon, verse 44, there were two walls. One was 12 feet thick. The outer wall was 21 feet thick. Three chariots could ride abreast around the whole wall. And the Euphrates River could be diverted in between the walls. Boy, it was some fortification. It fell in Daniel chapter 5. You might want to see in this same chapter, it's going to talk about it falling by surprise. That's Daniel chapter 5. Let's see. Notice where it mentions, back down in verse 59, it goes back to a dating time, back in the reign of Zedekiah, and that's showing you the dating problem. Well, I've just run out of time. My outline is very detailed. I hope you'll look at that, because this was too much to cover, and yet it's so important we see it. It's one literary unit. It's all of these little nations that fell before God's instrument of judgment, Babylon. And now Babylon herself will fall before Medo-Persia. What it says is, we reap what we sow. If we live by the sword, we'll die by the sword. And that's what it's talking about. We need to hear that today. God's in control of history. He's in control of Russia. He's in control of the United States. He's in control of all things. We need to trust Him. I've enjoyed being with you, and I'll see you again same time, same place next week. God bless you.